order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, February 19, 2008. We have public hearings scheduled on several bills. We've got a pretty tight calendar here today. And just to roadmap it for you, we're going to take the second bill out of order first. That's Senate Bill 1072. And then go back to the top of the agenda and go in order. 1086, then 1088, and then 1095. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1072A. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1072A comes to you from Senator Courtney, who carried the bill on the Senate side, increases the penalty for participating in dogfight from an A misdemeanor to a C felony, increases the penalty for possessing dogfighting paraphernalia from an A misdemeanor to a C felony, defines for the purpose of dogfighting paraphernalia a treadmill as a carpet mill made of narrow sections of a carpet, a modified electric treadmill for the purpose of conditioning dogs, or a slat mill with running surfaces constructed of wooden slats, requires the possession of this material be for the purpose of training a dog as a fighting dog, and also the amendments were adopted in the Senate side clarifies that a person advertising or otherwise offering to sell equipment for training and handling fighting dog know that the equipment will be used for those purposes.
Very good. President Courtney, would you come forward, and do you have others with you? Very good. We're ready when you are, President Courtney.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Islandview Drive North, here in Salem, 97303. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem and all of Jervis and Woodburn. And I hope that you're being handed now my official written testimony that I like to file with any and all committees that I appear before. Senate Bill 1072, when I introduced it, actually surprised me, because I'll be frank with you, those who know me, I am I like animals, and I like dogs. And so I don't quite know where the idea came from, whether it was because of what happened on the East Coast or whether the Humane Society was somewhere in there, so I introduced the bill. And then when I introduced it, I had no idea that it would lead me into the directions that it has, and that we'd end up with a unanimous vote on the state Senate floor. Because while it's very serious, the magnitude of it in our state, which caught me by surprise, and if you get a list of the groups that are supporting this bill, it's just overwhelming, the list of law enforcement groups that are supporting this bill. And you're going to hear from a variety of witnesses today, from a variety of groups about this measure. And you begin to realize what makes it so serious. It's a horrible thing. I mean, that's just the way I feel about it. I have no use for animal cruelty. I just can't abide it. And that's horrible enough. But what's interesting is how much related it is to other major crimes that are going on. In the gang area, the organized crime area, the drug dealing area, it is very, very serious and very significant. So this is not just about dog fighting. This is about serious other crimes that are going on, very much underworld, very much in secret what is going on here. And as we speak to you today about that, is that we also increasingly know, and I've used this phrase on the Senate floor, and I believe it's appropriate and proper to do so, this is a gateway crime. This is a gateway crime. We know that individuals that will be involved in animal cruelty often can end up being sexual predators. We know that, and become serial murderers. There's no doubt about that. As in certified smart Peter, I'm not a psychiatrist, but we know that animal cruelty is very much in the lives of people that go on and do horrible, heinous things, and predation in the area of murdering. So there's also that whole thing. So it's not just about dogfighting. It's disgraceful and disgusting as I find that. In addition, if you review the present statutes already in law, this legislature, that is not necessarily this legislature, past legislatures have said it's a Class C felony to, you know, sponsor dog fights, to train dogs to fight. It goes on and on. But there's two loopholes. If you attend a dog fight or you have dog fighting paraphernalia, it's a mere misdemeanor. So all we're saying by this bill is, if we're going to say it's a Class C felony, and we should and have in the past, if you promote a dog fight, you have a venue for a dog fight, you train dogs to dog fight, you own dogs to dog fight, we say, oh, that's a Class C felony. If you attend one of these things, and by the way, that's where they make their money. They make their money. And you don't just simply accidentally show up in these things, because they know, the law enforcement, that they're being watched all the time to try to figure out where this is going on. So they're very careful who they invite to these things. You don't just, I didn't know it was a dog fight. None of that. Don't give me that. That's not the case at all, truly. And so you know what you're doing when you go to bet and pay for and wager on these fights. In addition, dog paraphernalia, part of the present problem we're having now is it's hard to prove you're training them. But if you own dog paraphernalia, dog fighting paraphernalia, which we define in the law, that helps the law enforcement people to say, you know, you only have dogs, you're training them, you got dog paraphernalia. So basically what we tried to do with this bill is to close all the loopholes and say, once and for all, you're not dog fighting in the state of Oregon. And we're very, very serious about it. It is a Class C felony, which means you can go to jail for up to 5 years, and you can be fined for up to, is it $250,000? I think it's, excuse me?
I think $125,000.
Okay, I'm sorry, $125,000 to both. Thank you. So I made a mistake there. So rather than have me read all through my testimony, which is before you, I don't like to do that, which talks to a mother, a major, I have set forward the case there. In addition, I picked up Malik Taylor and Darren Robinson. These are Leslie, a middle school young man, who started to follow this, and they showed up in the Senate and then in the House who want to talk about this bill. Also, there's a lot of other people behind me, law enforcement, Humane Society, want to talk about it. So, again, I spoke extemporaneously, Mr. Chair. I didn't speak from notes on this one, and I think I covered my testimony, but I also think I covered all the things we covered in the Judiciary Committee over in the Senate, as well as on the Senate floor, as they say, which surprised me, because really, when I introduced the bill, Chair, I thought it was strictly about just dog fighting. Well, did I get an education about dog fighting? And by the way, it is going on in the state of Oregon. You may not think it is. You may think it's only going on back in Virginia because of that famous case, but it's going on the world in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for even allowing me to come here today. Thank you for even considering this bill. It's always an honor and privilege to be before any Judiciary Committee. I've always said the Judiciary Committee, in my humble opinion, no disrespect, is the greatest of all legislative committees. So that's
Well, you will get no disagreement on that point from us.
People probably think I'm trying to get in your good side. You're wrong. I've always said the one committee I wanted to chair all my life was Judiciary, and I never got to do that. So you ought to feel pretty good about yourself, Chair McPherson.
I do for all kinds of reasons, okay. But not least for that reason.
So thank you, and I'll stay here as long as you want me to and take your questions, comments, or criticisms. But we got two young men here that... it's very interesting. I always like it when the youths figure out, you know, I feel strong about that. And I didn't recruit them. They showed up, and here they are.
Well, we will accommodate your schedule in whatever way. We'd like to hear from them, but if you'd like to...
I'd like to hear from
them,
too.
Very good. Darren or Malik, which one of you like to go first? And then start out by identifying yourself for the record.
My name is Malik Taylor, and I go to Leslie Middle School.
That's fine for identifying yourself. Now tell us what you think about this bill.
This bill is really good because dogfighting is a really bad thing, and in Oregon, dogfighting, you know, it's not as bad as like California or some other state that has a felony. Like dogfighting be a felony, and here it's only a misdemeanor, and to be a spectator it's only a felony. I mean a misdemeanor. Sorry, and it's like a loophole because everyone that is at a dogfight or the people that are hosting the dogfight claim to be spectators, but they are actually the people holding the dogfight. So they only get a misdemeanor of $2,200.
Very good. Darren, why don't you start by identifying yourself for the record?
My name is Darren Robertson, and I go to Leslie Middle School. And the first thing that got us interested in this was the Michael Vick case, because he's a role model for both of us, like, growing up. And then we heard that he was, like, involving himself in dogfighting. So then we started a project called Change the World. And then, basically you pick a problem in your community and try to fix it and write a report and call to action, and then you do a speech about it. And, yeah.
Dog fighting leads to other crimes, such as serial killing, illegal gambling, drugs, and... yeah.
And for closing statement, we put I said that if we don't add a harsher punish, I mean, if we do add a harsher punishment, then maybe dog fighting crime rate will go down. And if it does go down, you'll also notice other crime rate going down.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you, all three of you, for coming, but particularly Malik and Darren for coming out and presenting on this bill. This is the way democracy works, is that people, citizens, get interested in an issue, and they come to the Capitol, and they present their views. So you're getting an early start on it, and I hope that this will not be your last appearance at the Capitol, that you'd engage other issues and bring your ideas forward to us in the future on them. Are there any questions? Representative Krieger.
I think most of us, I can't speak for anyone else, but I don't support dog fighting, I don't support cock fighting, I don't even support bullfighting as in Mexico, the way it's done there. And this is the, I've waited 7 years, 1 month, and 19 days for the first opportunity to probe the depths of our President of the Senate's mind. And this bill is not controversial. It's a good bill, and I find it disappointing that I'm going to have to support it, and I'm not going to be able to probe.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask, is it Malik and
yeah.
Darren? If you know the answer to this question, and if you don't, maybe President Courtney can help you. Do you know how much dogfighting there is in Oregon? Are you aware of some around where you live, or... how do you know how much is going on in the state? And thank you for being here.
I think Senator Courtney might know that one.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, did they hand out the endorsement, the list of all those that were endorsing this measure? Without me going down the counties and the cities and the associations there, I think that speaks to the magnitude of this particular issue. I do not know the actual percentages of that, but I think that this speaks to the magnitude of what they're finding out there that is going on. That's the best way I know how to answer the question. We do have law enforcement people that are going to testify, and I think they probably can give me more detailed information. But I frankly was surprised at the endorsement list if you look at the geographic area that it represents as well as the different jurisdictions, it's substantial.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I would like to just make a comment as a previous high school administrator in Woodburn. I first came upon this issue when we were dealing with gangs in the height of the mid-90s, and students told me they were raising dogs for this purpose, and I was just in shock, and I said, well, and I got more information, and I just... yeah, it's appalling. And so, Senator, I appreciate this. And I have just one question for the students, because I used to be a teacher. So who's your social studies teacher? Is this where you're doing the project?
Yeah.
Okay, what's their name?
My social studies teacher's name is Mr. Hall.
What?
Kevin Hall.
Tell him thank you.
Okay.
Okay, if there are no further questions, thank you, President
Thank
Courtney.
You very much.
Thank you,
Thanks
Malik.
Much.
Thank you, Darren. Great job. have Scott Heiser come forward and Kelly Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Heiser. I'm with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, a private nonprofit organization. My job with the ALDF is to assist prosecutors all over the country with the prosecution of animal cruelty cases, including animal fighting cases, dog fighting as well. I've done a number of trainings regarding how to prosecute animal fighting cases, including dog fighting cases. I'm a former prosecutor. I used to be the elected DA in Benton County, Oregon, and Regarding the previous question about the volume of animal fighting in Oregon, I've submitted a public records request to the department, or the Oregon Judicial Department, asking for the statistics on the number of cases filed. I haven't gotten a response from that yet, so I can only give you anecdotal information. And my estimate is that in Oregon, on an annual basis, we probably only prosecute across the state less than 25 to 15 cases a year. The majority of these cases are stumbled upon by virtue of investigating other types of crimes, drug arrests primarily. Oftentimes, they're missed because law enforcement isn't aware of what they're seeing. They see a number of pits being raised, and they think, well, that's interesting, they're just raising pits. Well, there are a number of other indicators, including the definition of paraphernalia that we're expanding with this bill, that law enforcement needs to be aware of so that they can adequately investigate these cases and bring the charges. But primarily, I'm here today to offer any advice or answer any questions that you may have. The feedback that I got in preparing for today's testimony was there may be some concern about elevating the participating in a dogfight or the possession of paraphernalia to a felony crime for fear that innocence might be captured or swept into this conduct or this offense and ultimately convicted of a felony. And I would remind you that in addition to the prosecutorial discretion that all DAs have regarding how to file a case as either a felony or a misdemeanor, there's also a judicial safety valve in Chapter 161 that gives the trial court, at the time of sentencing, the option of reducing a felony down to a misdemeanor. So there's ample protection for those offenders that anybody may have concern about being swept into this bill that perhaps may not have been intended to be captured here. With that, I'll open it up to any questions you might have.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heiser, if in a scenario where, you know, an 18-year-old is coaxed into going to a dogfight and just simply attending, first of all, do they have to pay admission under this bill in order to get charged with this felony?
No, there's no requirement. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. There's no requirement to be convicted of attending a dogfight that you actually pay the admission fee. It is common to be required to pay to get into these events. It becomes part of the purse. That's part of the money that's distributed on the win. But you don't have to be a paying customer to be convicted under the language in the statute.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So then in that scenario where I think a lot of what the proponents have banked on is the proper discretion on behalf of the prosecutors. If they get into a situation where they're in plea negotiations, what would be the likely offense and consequence of if they weren't going to hit them with the full felony, what would be the penalty for somebody pleading to a lesser charge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, in my past career as a prosecutor, if I'm confronted with that fact scenario, an 18-year-old with a clean record who's at a dogfight, chances are pretty good that my offer to him or her is going to be, you tell me everything you know about this dogfight, who organized it, who put it on, and you work me up the food chain, for lack of a better term, and I'll give you a misdemeanor, perhaps even as generous as a diversion, which means you don't even have a conviction on a first offense. Now, that's my own decision-making. I can't speak for other currently elected DAs on how that might play out. Depending on the level of cooperation and willingness to provide information, that will drive the analysis from my perspective.
And then one final follow-up. Under that scenario, then, if the person didn't play ball, you would probably pursue the felony case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, yes, I believe I would.
Any further questions for Mr. Heiser? Councilor Taylor.
Chairman of the Committee. Mr. Heiser, when I was a kid, I used to have a little wire fox terrier, and he used to love to start fights, particularly with bigger dogs. My assumption is that if I was standing and my dog was having a fight, I wouldn't be participating as a spectator in a dog fight. I take it would have to be something more organized than that. Is that correct? And if so, could you give us an example of what you would consider where it would rise to the level of attending a dog fight?
Mr. Chair, Council, if your dog gets into a fight at a park, that's not going to fall within the definition of dogfighting as currently codified in Oregon. That definition, I think, is less than vague. I think it's very clear about what conduct is captured, and I have no concerns that the statutory language would address your scenario that you've proposed.
Further follow, what level of organization would you see where it would be attending a dogfight then?
Mr. Chair, a dogfight that this bill is intended to cover is, for practical purposes, almost invariably going to involve pit bulls, almost invariably it's going to involve some form of a contract, an agreement between the parties about what the terms of the engagement are, specifically what the rules are, Cajun versus other rules of dogfighting, what the weight classifications are going to be, who's going to be the handler in the pit for each dog, and what the payout structure is going to be, who's going to provide security, all those types of things. This is a highly organized enterprise, and that's the type of evidence that I'd be looking for with respect to the fight itself. There is other indications of dogfighting that are prevalent in the training, in the breeding, that type of thing, but for the fight itself, that's the scenario I'm looking for.
So, a further question, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I was going to be. Mr. Heiser, so it would be clear to the spectators that they weren't, it wasn't an ad hoc dogfight. It was something that was planned, and there were elements around it that would make any person know that it was a planned dogfight.
Mr. Chair, Council, you bet. The definition of dogfighting, just for purposes of the record, it's in 167, 360, sub 3. Dogfight means a fight arranged by any person. So it's the arrangement, it's the agreement, it's the creation of the event that we're looking for.
Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heiser, I'm curious about the use of the phrase equipment in line 8 of the A engrossed version. I was trying to find out what that means because somebody can be liable if they advertise equipment that they should have known would be used for the purpose of training or in handling a fighting dog, but I can't find the definition of equipment in here. And say, for example, PetSmart advertises collars, and a collar is used, reasonably should have known, could be used for training a fighting dog. So I'm trying to figure out how you can define why. I'm concerned that that's broad, because the advertising and the equipment, which is not defined. I see paraphernalia is defined, but equipment is not.
Right.
So how is that? How do you see that as more narrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is existing law, by the way, and it's intended, in my opinion, to be much broader than the stricter definitions of paraphernalia because of the qualifying culpable mental state. If I work at PetSmart and I'm selling a 3-inch leather collar that's typically used for weighting down the necks of these pit bulls, and I'm just a clerk there and I sell it to some person, the prosecutor in the law enforcement community, they don't have a case against me because there is no evidence, direct or circumstantial, that the clerk at PetSmart knew of or reasonably should have known that this person was a dogfighter, and therefore that this equipment, these pieces of property that are being sold out of PetSmart were going to be used for purposes of facilitating a dogfight. There needs to be, for this to be a viable prosecution under that specific clause, evidence that the person making the transaction or offering the goods for sale knew or reasonably should have known that it was going to be used for fighting. So in that scenario, play with the facts just a bit. If I'm the clerk at PetSmart, and a person comes in and is talking dog fighting specific with the clerk about, yeah, this is a great call, I got some fighting pits and I got a fight in San Francisco in 2 weeks and I'm going to truck them down, then we have an issue. It's, again, hopefully to answer your question, it's that knows or reasonably should have known language that qualifies equipment, and therefore the expanded definition isn't really an issue because you have to have that knowledge before it becomes a concern.
A brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Was there a discussion about defining equipment so that was clear what was encompassed within that? Because I'm concerned about the advertising portion.
Understood. Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe that there was any concern. I certainly don't have any concern with the current language of the bill. And for what it's worth, on the Senate side, I was speaking with counsel for the indigent defense folks, and we specifically addressed this language to clarify this provision so that the culpable mental state was included to narrow the application of this statute to hopefully address the concerns that you're articulating today.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Shields. Mr. Ezra, do you have any sense of where the criminal defense bar comes down on this bill? Or are they going to be testifying?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Ann, come on up.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to answer Representative Shields' question on the Senate side, after discussions with the two proponents and an agreement for what I thought was a friendly amendment to narrow the scope of some of the provisions, we took the position that we would be neutral on the bill.
Okay. Thanks. Ms. Judy Carter-Nathan.
Yeah, for the record.
I'm sorry, for the record. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the bill, but I'm concerned about unforeseen consequences of the treadmill. I asked my honey friend down at the other end of the podium here, is are treadmills used for dogs? Mrs. Christian, you may, is this, so, you know, what if if someone's using a treadmill to work a hunting dog or to condition a hunting dog, is that going to be a problem in, you know, in this situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the definition of possessing dogfighting paraphernalia is a specific intent crime that requires the state to prove that the person in possession of the treadmill was using the treadmill.
Yeah, they've changed that. Right here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does that cover for him? Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Can I ask one more question, Mr. Chair? I'm torn by this bill, and perhaps, Ms. Christian, you can help me get to a yes on it. We talked about the safeguard that the judges have, the option of downward departure in cases where they feel like the DAs did not use proper discretion, or perhaps. So I was just, in everyday life in the courtroom, do you have a sense of whether or not that is an adequate safeguard? Does that happen frequently?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, for the record again, Ann Christian representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I apologize that I've been in and out during the hearing. There are two matters that may help explain why, after the agreement on the amendment, we took the position of being neutral. Number one is that the current felony offense of dogfighting is an unranked crime on the sentencing guidelines grid. What that means is that you will not find on this grid any grid blocks for dog fighting. The same, I've talked with the director of the Criminal Justice Commission who indicates, although he cannot commit the commission, he would anticipate that these two new elevated Class C felonies as well would be unranked. What's the significance of a crime being unranked is that a judge has really total discretion to determine what the sentence will be. The judge is not limited by the sentencing guidelines, grids, or the rules. So that certainly played in our discussions with the proponents and also our position. So as a practical matter, an individual who is before a judge on one of the two new Class C felonies, the judge would have total ability to look, as Mr. Heiser indicated, whether or not the person is a first offender, what degree of implication the person had with paraphernalia or being at the dogfight. So the fact that current crime of dogfighting and these two new Class C felonies would probably be unranked gives the court a lot of discretion compared to other felonies.
And follow-ups, and they would also have discretion to go down to misdemeanor from the bench.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, no. The judge on his or her own would not have the authority to reduce the Class C felony to a misdemeanor, unless I'm mistaken.
Mr. Chair, if I might just offer a bit of reminder to counsel. It's 161705, where the court on a conviction for certain Class C felonies and certain drug offenses does have the discretion to reduce the offense at the time of sentencing or after successful completion of probation from a felony to a misdemeanor to avoid some of the stigma that attaches to a felony conviction for those people that the judge deems to be worthy of that relief.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, my understanding was that was dependent on the district attorney agreeing to that. Am I mistaken, or?
I believe that's true. Let me double check. That language does not exist in 705. It might be in another provision, Ann, but I don't see it.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would correct my response that apparently a judge, even if the district attorney opposed the judge treating the Class C felony as a misdemeanor, the judge would have that authority, which is good.
Mr. Heiser, do we need to do anything more to nail that down? Because I'd say that the, I think that the one piece of this that I think is would be sensitive or kind of concern to the, to at least some members of the committee would be to somebody who is purely in a spectator role would, through an exercise of discretion on the part of a district attorney's office, wind up charged with a felony as a was part of an effort to try to go up the chain to try to identify the people who are really putting on the dogfight. But if that didn't work out that way and the person ended up being charged, if the having the safety valve of the court being able on its initiative to then say, no, we think that the right response is the misdemeanor, that would be, and I think would be an important reassurance to some committee members.
Mr. Chair, I have not done an extensive bit of research on this issue. I just looked at 161.705 this morning in preparation for today, and I didn't run down the additional language that may, and I'm having a similar memory, like maybe there might be an issue there. I'd be happy to look into it. It'll take me 20 minutes. But as a reminder, you know, a person that attends a dogfight, if this bill is enacted, is liable for a Class C felony, period. That's the law if we enact it. And if they're convicted of that, what's unjust about that? They committed the offense. They have collateral relief. They have the ability to seek to set aside certain convictions after 3 years of successful completion of probation and the like as well. But there's two safety valves. Again, the DA's office has the discretion not to prosecute it as a felony at the outset. They also have the opportunity to offer the defendant a plea to a lesser charge at the inception of the case or early in the case. And then lastly, the issue of the judge's discretion to exercise some relief. So there's that, plus don't forget about post-conviction relief.
Ms. Christian, do you think there's any more that we should be trying to pin down here today before acting on the bill?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Heiser suggested maybe with 20 minutes.
Why don't we excuse the two of you from the witness table? We'll hear from Ms. Peterson. There's several other people signed up. And if we could get confirmation on that point, I think that might be reassuring.
Chair, the District Attorney's Association is also represented, as well as the Marion County DA, so maybe they could all get together.
Sure. Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You.
Ms. Peterson.
Chair McPherson and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm the Oregon State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. And I will say what the Michael Vick case did do was it did bring to light what really law enforcement and animal control agencies and humane societies have known, is that really the issue of dog fighting is prevalent. And after the Michael Vick case, what animal control agencies and law enforcement did here in Oregon is that they immediately, within the last 3 months, we've held two animal fighting trainings in Oregon. One was in Madras and one was in Salem. And it was sponsored by district attorneys, local district attorneys, and animal control agencies, and sheriff and police departments. And a copy of one of the media announcements is in your packet, and I just included that. Some of the stuff is confidential for law enforcement and how to detect dogfighting, but I wanted to include that. You know, we think the bill is really a deterrent. It does draw a big red line that says that this act is really just not acceptable and it should be avoided at all costs. I mean, you know, when you're taking these characteristics, these positive characteristics in dogs, and exploiting them and really turning them into violent animal weapons, and that's what they become. I also included in your packet a copy of a statistical 3-year study by the Chicago Police Department, and it found really some surprising statistics, though we've all kind of anecdotally known of this, but 70% of those arrested for animal crimes, and they just looked at animal crimes over a 3-year period, found that 70% had been arrested for other felonies, and 65% had been arrested for battery charges, ranging from aggravated battery to just battery, and 70% had been arrested for narcotics charges. You know, I think it's important to set some sort of signal that indicates to adults and to youth that this isn't a hobby and a sport to be engaged in. It's a crime. But beyond that, it's twofold. You also have to work within the community. And because of this Chicago study, and I just wanted to give just briefly what we're doing in Chicago, is that We're working with the Chicago Project Violence Prevention. It's Ceasefire. And we've created these. We're working with the violence interrupters on the streets there. That's just, there's several layers to that program. But it's basically instituting mentors in that area to try to find humane alternatives and other, just some good training for how to work with their dogs. And what we're going to do is, that's kind of a laboratory there, and whatever works, we would like to take that into other communities to work on the streets. And let's see what else. I know you have other people here testifying. There have been some statistics. People do say how much dog fighting is out there. There is a researcher. It's Dr. Kronover. He's a renowned dog fighting expert. He's putting together a book that data will be published. He estimates that there's 250,000 dogs in dog fighting pits each year. And there's about 40,000 people involved in it, in the organized activity. And then there's another 100,000 dog fighters on the streets. And I've included in your packet just some sampling of what we've been able to tell just in the media, and some about the problem here. It's not a complete list by any means, but it is there. And with that, I have about 6 copies of our animal sheltering magazine. It's something that's distributed to animal control agencies and humane societies. And this one spotlights dog fighting, the cost of shelters and the cost to communities. It actually highlights a case in Oregon, but it also talks about the cases that are happening all over the country. So I'll just, if you guys want to just circulate it.
Yeah, would you just hand the staff to pass out here?
And I have much more, but I know there's others who are wanting to testify. So I'll leave it unless you have questions.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Peterson?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question. Thank you. Kelly, do you have any sense of what's I'm sort of hung up on this advertising part here. What is that intended to get after? What type of advertising is there done for equipment?
Thank you. Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici. So this was existing language. We didn't really touch
right.
that. We tried to accommodate others, but you know, there's actually quite a few websites. Well, first off, there's a variety of things. These big collars that will be used for dogs, but they can also be used for other instances. So it's knowingly being used for participating in a dog fight. And so, though I wasn't the author of this section, but I'll tell you just separately, there are items that are sold on Amazon.com. This isn't necessarily equipment, but there are magazines that cater specifically to dog fighting that are still sold legally. There are websites that advertise to be selling, you know, in large part cat mails, these things that are used to train dogs, spring poles, and those things that are, you know, they're selling them knowingly that they're going to be used in a dog fight. In fact, I was just on some websites a couple days ago where, you know, they're selling those items.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Peterson? Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Okay. We have several more people signed up, and I'm going to bring them actually up in pairs here. Ron Nelson and Kevin Campbell next.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here this morning to lend our support to Senate Bill 1072, both on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and also on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. They were unable to be here to present, but they wanted me to communicate their support for the bill. I'm also submitting some testimony on behalf of Molly Dahl. Molly's someone that I wish could be here today. She's a homicide detective from Portland, has had personal experience in an investigation relating to dogfighting. Interestingly enough, it was a homicide that took her to dogfighting, which is not uncommon, and it's already been mentioned this morning, and I don't want to belabor the point that these are events that carry with them all kinds of other criminal activity. They don't sell popcorn at these events. These are not like watching a movie. There is criminal activity throughout, and you'll find a lot of criminal experience among the people that attend. So on behalf of Molly, I'm submitting that. I wanted to just read one very brief paragraph from her testimony. She just says, "What I've discovered is dogfighting is alive and well in the state of Oregon. Until recently, the public has chosen to believe that dogfighting doesn't exist. Due to the shameful participation of professional athletes both locally and nationally, a horrifying sport has come to light. Historically, dogfighting has been here a long time, but there is an alarming trend now that encompasses a wider community. It's traveled to the inner cities and has been embraced by armed gangs and drug dealers. Dogfighting is a criminal enterprise that closely associates itself to violence, to include murder, as was the case in the case she investigated." And so I wanted to mention that for the record. I don't want to take any more of the committee's time because I know you have a lot of people before you, but I wanted to go on record in support of the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Let's go to Mr. Nelson, and then we'll have questions.
My name is Ron Nelson. I'm a special agent in the Organized Crime Unit for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here representing the Oregon Department of Justice and as past president of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. We believe that dogfighting is an organized criminal event, and it also entails or it is related to many other crimes such as drug cases. I think that I can best describe my experience through an investigation I conducted that began as a drug case. It's quite old. It was here in Marion County. Began in 1991. And the informant in this case was arrested in a different jurisdiction for trafficking in precursor chemicals for the manufacture of methamphetamine. He cooperated with law enforcement on a conspiracy to commit murder case. He was a person who was involved with and familiar with dogfighting as well. Once that conspiracy to commit murder case was concluded, the informant was introduced to me at the Oregon Department of Justice, and he described to me a person in Marion County who was a dogfighter and a marijuana grower. I understood how to investigate marijuana cases, but I didn't know much about dogfighting at the time. So I did some research. I did find, through my research, a underground publication in which the many of the paraphernalia items that are described in this bill were advertised. Dogfights around the United States were advertised. Stud fees were advertised. A lot of advertisement regarding what was happening that showed me that this was indeed a crime, an organized criminal group that was in the business for profit. And as the case developed, we did identify 30 marijuana plants being grown at two locations in Marion County. We conducted our investigation, and we found, after executing a search warrant, the marijuana plants and 25 pit bulls all staked out on some rural property east of Salem. These dogs had battle scars from fighting. We found many of the items of paraphernalia that are listed in this bill. And the people were convicted of dog fighting and drug offenses. That's my experience with dog fighting in Marion County. And we, of course, are in support of this bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Agent Nelson, we heard earlier that at the level of prosecution, it's probably a couple of handfuls, maybe a couple dozen or less a year here in Oregon. But what I'm hearing you say is that the depth of the problem is much more expansive. And so would you suggest there are like hundreds of these types of enterprises in Oregon that we just don't know because it's organized below the surface crime?
Well, I couldn't really speak to how many there are because obviously we don't know that. I can say, though, that it was a pretty detailed publication that we were reading, and it did advertise a lot of different fights. However, trying to pinpoint those particular dog fighters in the state of Oregon, it could only be done by their phone number that was published for advertising purposes. So I don't really remember how many of those were in Oregon. As I recall, there were maybe a couple in that publication. But that's not to say that everybody used the publication. So there could have been more out there that we just weren't familiar with.
Just a quick follow-up.
Okay.
And so it's just by virtue of it being underground and organized level of crime activity, there's no way to wrap your hands around it, but it's probably a lot more expansive than we seem to
yes.
be able to evidence.
Yes.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then we'll excuse these witnesses. And the last two on the sign-up list are Dr. Larry Peets and Susan Metley. And while they're coming forward, let me just explain to people in the room that we have four bills set for hearing today. The way things are proceeding, I think it's quite unlikely we will get to the last two of those. And we'll be rolling those over until tomorrow's meeting. But I do hope to get through both 1072 and 1086 today. And I'd say Dr. Peets.
Hi, I'm Dr. Larry Peets. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm here just as a concerned citizen, and I would encourage you to pass and support Senate Bill 1072. My involvement with this, I've listened to all the testimony before you, and I think I would be surprised if anyone were to find opposition to this proposed legislation. As a veterinarian, there are two things that come to mind that I think you should be aware of. The first is that these animals that participate in this are not inherently vicious animals. They are forced through training and into an unnatural circumstance to participate in this sport for, if you can call it that, in this activity for the monetary gain of participants. And this is not an activity that you're going to stumble upon and just be inadvertently involved in. It's organized, and they're there to bet on the outcome of this fight. Left to their own, these animals may fight, as you were mentioning, about the dog fighting in the street. But when they endure some pain, they will leave the scene of the fight. In this activity, they are not allowed to leave. They are forced to fight until they can't, till exhaustion. The other thing that you should be aware of is that these animals are not then brought to a veterinarian for treatment because of the fear of prosecution, and something that's even more abhorrent to me is the fact that they're not brought because it's going to cost them some money to have these animals repaired. I was involved in 1991 at the bequest of Attorney General Dave Frohnmayer to participate in a raid on dogfighting operation, the one that Mr. Nelson spoke of before. The equipment is very special in its use. They do use treadmills, but one thing that I do recall in the training of these dogs is that there was an apparatus that was brace that was suspended on the wall that was attached to a harness, and on the other end of it was a weight, 35-45 pound weight. The harness is attached to the dog, and in order to gain access to water and food, this dog had to lift the weight off the ground as he walked across the room to gain access to water and food. So this activity is something that the normal person does not become involved in, and I think the consequences of involvement in this activity should be significant so that they are discouraged from being involved in it. So Thank you for your time. I know you guys have got a lot on your plate. There's many issues, but this is something that should demand your attention now and not later. So thank you.
Ms. Bentley.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Susan Mentley. I work at the Oregon Humane Society, which is located in Portland. I've been in the business for about 30 years now, having worked also in the Marion County Shelter and Bend and a couple other shelters. So I have had experience with dogfighting and, more importantly, the ramifications of what's left over. And driving down here this morning, I was thinking, what can I do to tell you something different? Obviously, you've had some very powerful testimony, and it's suffice to say there's nothing good about dog fighting. However, on a personal level, as a shelter worker, I can tell you that I've had to kill many, many pit bulls over the years. It is legion within the business for animal shelters or animal controls to not place these animals into new homes. So if we get an adult pit bull with cut ears and any type of scarring, they're automatically euthanized. Pit bulls, as Dr. Peach mentioned, can be wonderful companions. They're just big, goofy, lovable lugheads, and many times they remain very, very safe and friendly to humans while they've inadvertently been turned into weapons within the dogfighting world. So they're not safe to place. They just have to be euthanized. And on a personal level, I can speak for animal shelter workers and animal control workers, that is a very painful thing to have to do. This has painted a rather broad picture on the entire breed. Pit bulls are difficult to place in the community because of housing and insurance restrictions, even public perception. So it takes us a long time to place even a very friendly pit bull. We did go out on a limb with the Quintel Woods dogs. We got two of his dogs, Hollywood and Sugar. Those were the names he gave them. Kind of an odd thing. And we did place them very, very carefully. They're doing well, but it was a huge liability to do that. And in most cases, we can't go the distance with those dogs. We just felt an especial sense of responsibility with those poor animals. So that's really all I wanted to let you know, is that there is another very human side and a very painful side to shelter workers. The poor pit bull breed has been maligned by this ridiculous activity, and I think we have an opportunity in Oregon to do something about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mentley. Any questions for either of these witnesses? I've been seeing none. We'll excuse them. And I think we have nobody else signed up, but the one other item we were going to try to confirm is the point that was raised earlier about whether, and Mr. Heiser, if you could just come forward to put that on the record, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Scott Heiser, Animal Legal Defense Fund, members of the committee. We did confer in the hallway, double-check my thinking on the statute. My read is correct. That statute can be operated, be placed into operation by a court on the court's own motion in his or her, the judge's discretion, without consent from the prosecutor. That's 161705.
Very good. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might just throw one more thing in, just for the record, 19 other states within the country now felonize participation and attendance of a dogfight, so Oregon would be the 20th if we enact the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heiser. That concludes the testimony on Senate Bill 1072, so I'll close the public hearing, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1072.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1072 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 1072 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Good discussion.
Mr. Chair. Representative Shields.
Thank you. I've been pretty torn about this, but I think my concerns about judicial discretion and whether there might be the option of a bit of a safety valve have been answered, and I will be voting yes on this measure.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Cameron?
Aye.
Representative
Flores?
Aye.
Representative Hall? Aye. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Parker?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Motion carries. Senate Bill 1072 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, would you carry that?
I will.
Very good. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1072 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1086.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1086 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee, and this is a bill that's intended to answer a problem that was created by House Bill 3407 last session. Before 3407 was adopted, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, public safety officers' records were automatic if they requested excluded from disclosure or to be redacted. Telephone numbers and other information like that, and all records except real property records. Last session, you may remember, in 3407, we amended the law to allow district attorneys, assistant district attorneys, and assistant AGs plus law enforcement to have their information redacted from the public record. But what we did is we said only to certain particular records, and in that case, it would be the real property records or the voter registration record. And in doing so, what we forgot about is that oftentimes the Department of the DPSST has this information in their records. So what we did is we took away the protection that police officers would have in those records. And this amendment that you have, the bill that you have before you, was intended to address that by saying that if a police officer requests that his name and telephone number and other home address not be disclosed by the DPSST, they have the ability to say that they won't disclose it.
Okay. Very good. We have Brian DeLeshment signed up.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLeshment, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Your council has done a very good job of describing the bill as it came across from the Senate. It was, of course, our bill over the last few sessions that was cleaned up last session and inadvertently altered to make the exclusion that they didn't get coverage under DPSST. We urge passage of the bill, and I'm available for any questions.
Any questions of Mr. DeLeshman? Okay. Thank you, Mr. DeLeshman. Carolyn Lawrence.
You have your phone here on the dash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And my written testimony provides a little more background on this bill from the perspective of the department. And I know you've had a full day and a good explanation by committee counsel. My sole purpose for being here is to say that Senate Bill 1086A accomplishes what was of concern to the department, and that is to restore our ability to protect the personal address and phone number of public safety officers for whom we have that information in our records. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Lawrence? Okay, thank you very much. Jack Evans with ODOT.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I'm here to talk to the Dash 8 amendments that we just received to this bill. ODOT operates a couple of address protection programs, one under ORS 192445, which deals with victims of domestic violence and other individuals that are in some type of danger. DMV masks the address of those individuals on their records. They don't give it out, but the real address appears on their driver's license. On the records, the DMV headquarters address appears. The second program is the public officials program under 802-250, and that exclusively shows the work address in our records and on the individual's driver's license, and that covers federal officers, DAs, police officers, all those types of individuals. We just received the Dash 8 amendments, which would include former officials, federal officials and state officials, police, etc. And we're taking a look at what that might mean to us in terms of workload. if indeed the individuals would use the work address under the current program, which is the in lieu of address for public officials, that's fine. And there really won't be much of a change for us, except for the volume of individuals we're dealing with. If former employees don't want a former or former employers do not want that former employee to use that work address, then we'll treat this in a sense as we do with the other program, which would show the real address on the driver's license, but would show the DMV headquarters address on the records, and that's what would be shown if it's ever if any information is ever given out. So we're fine with this. We'd move ahead and implement this. We're just not able yet to determine what the impact might be to us.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Evans? Just Representative Barker.
In one of the new things, one of the things came up last time was a federal. I think he was a DEA, former DEA agent, but now just as federal officers. And there's a question: is what does that mean? How broad is that? I mean. Is that Colonel Wisnant? Does he do that, or is he retired Air Force? Or
Representative or McPherson, Representative Barker, we're not entirely sure. Currently in the statute, it does mention DEA officers, FBI, and it spells out the various federal agencies. I'd suppose that you'd have to define that in rule in some fashion and either list the agencies or list some type of criteria for a qualifying agency.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Evans, I haven't had an opportunity. We just got the dash 8. Can you tell whose responsibility it would be then to determine which approach you would take if the former employer does not want the former employee to use that work address, and then you'd have to go to the alternate route of using the, I think you said the DOT address. Whose responsibility is it to make that determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we just also received the amendments, and it's our understanding that someone would come to us and apply for this program, and then we'd make a determination at that time in some fashion whether or not the former employer address could be used or whether or not we'd have to use the DMV headquarter address. But that would have to be hammered out.
Any further questions for Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, you mentioned the Dash 8. You're not sure to the extent that that would extend. What do you mean by that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'm simply talking about the number of individuals that we'd be dealing with. We don't have a sense right now when you use the term former official, the extent to which you, how would you narrow that down to certain situations of a former official, or if it's just wide open, we're trying to get a guesstimate at this time put together so we'd have a sense of what our workload is. And we're simply talking about the number of people that would be approaching us for this.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, we have other testimony on this, right?
We do, and actually we're kind of getting into the Dash 8 amendments, which I know Representative Crummell wanted to have an opportunity to come in and present. So I think that it may be appropriate to get him in here. There he is in the room. Let's have Mr. Crummell come forward, Representative Crummell come forward to present on the Dash 8 amendments, because we've gotten input on the bill as it came to us, and now we're getting input on an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. And yes, Mr. Chair, I am here to speak to the Dash 8 amendments. What these, and actually I had the Dash 7, A7 amendments drafted also, but there was a minor little problem with those, and so the Dash 8 fixes that minor little problem. This was brought to me by a constituent who is a former FBI agent that lives in my district. No, he's a constituent, but yeah, okay, I said that right. He is concerned because folks that have been in his line of work face dangers even after retirement. And the dangers are that when the people, the bad people that they've put away, get out of prison, if they decide that they want to try to retaliate in any way. So he's concerned about the safety of himself and his family, but also the safety of other federal agents, and the fact that federal agents have not in the past fallen under any kind of a statutory scheme in the state. So and I know the question has come up about what, you know, what is a what's a federal agent, and I think it was just alluded to that the federal agents are in fact defined in state law. But Dave Hendricks is here also, and I'm sure he could answer that question much better than I can. But I think what, one of the things that we have to recognize is that our public safety officers, particularly police, become targets even after they are retired, and it doesn't really make sense to me that we would protect those that worked for the state or worked for a city or a county within the state, but we wouldn't protect federal agents who have either decided, I know Oregon is becoming such a mecca for retirement, I'm sure we'll have all of the federal agents retiring here, but I'm just being facetious. But I think that the bottom line is that it doesn't make sense to me that we don't protect the federal agents as well, and to me this seems like a pretty simple fix. And so that's why I'm here, is with relation to the Dash 8 amendments. I think that this is an important amendment to add into this bill. I know that there are maybe some other folks that might have a little consternation about it, but I think that if we're going to really protect our public safety officers, which I think is our responsibility in state law, that we really need to add the federal officers that have served our state and our country so well. Also, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, provided it's questions that I can answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill does define federal officer as defined in 133.005. Let me read that. Federal officer means a special agent or law enforcement officer employed by a federal agency and who is empowered to effect an arrest with or without a warrant for violations of the United States Code and who is authorized to carry firearms in the performance of duty.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, it sounds like that would include DEA, FBI, federal marshals, air marshals, probably potentially transportation safety. I don't know. But it sounds like that's pretty encompassing.
Representative Kremel, it looks like the amendment adds, if I'm following it right, two categories of expansion to the existing law. Mm-hmm. That is, it adds federal officers, active federal officers, in addition to DAs, that is Oregon state prosecutors and people who handle prosecution work within the Department of Justice. But it also extends for both categories to former people who used to perform those responsibilities. So both of those expansions are reflected in the Dash 8 amendments?
Mr. Chair, yes. Both are, and the reason why we're, as I mentioned before, that we're wanting to put the former, the retired agents in, is because, as I mentioned earlier, they are targets as well. You get a person that has been sentenced to however many years in prison for something that they were picked up by, they decide that they're going to retaliate because they haven't really been rehabilitated, and they come out and decide that, by God, you know, this yo-yo that put them away, they're going to put them away. So it really is a protection for the for our retired and former officers, as well as our current.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to our committee, Representative Kremel.
Thank you.
You might have heard the question I asked Mr. Evans. I'm trying to figure out how logistically this will work. If, for example, the category of former, either state or federal officers, if the former employer, for some reason or another, doesn't want that address used, and then they have to go over to the other category of apparently the DMV address, whose responsibility is it to make that determination? Is that the burden of the person, the former employee, or is it the burden of the Department of Motor Vehicles? I'm just trying to figure out how logistically that's going to work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, I think that Mr. Evans pretty well described it from a standpoint that the agency will have rules set out for what a person has to do to apply. So it would be the step of the former employee to take the step that say, yeah, I want the protection, so I'm going to make the application, and then at that point it's handed over. I would imagine anyway, it's handed over to the agency, and under their rules they will determine whether or not the person qualifies, and if they do, then make the determination if the employer is not willing to have that address as the alternate address. I think Mr. Evans stated that that they would use the DMV office as the address of record for that person, so that way there's the person's personal address is being protected. And I think that our agencies are perfectly capable of making that determination and under rule being able to execute the statute. I don't think that it would be, now I'm speaking from no real knowledge base here other than what I think, but I don't think that the cost to the agency is going to necessarily be any greater than the costs that they have already with regards to how they're already implementing protections for officers.
Thank you, Representative.
If there are no further questions, thank you, Representative Krimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Snyder, you're signed up. Are you coming to present on the main bill? Are you commenting on one of the amendments? What's your perspective?
A little bit of both, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why don't you and Mr. Gallagher come forward then here in committee? There's several of us have a commitment at 11:30, so we will be adjourning this meeting at 11:30 sharp, so we do need to allow a little time to work the bill if we're going to try to work it today. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. I've talked with all of you before the meeting, and I'm hearing information that causes me to have to reflect on what it said. We support the original bill. We spent all of last session and a great deal of time this session working out the details of that bill. This has now come in without anybody being able to walk through the same sort of exercise we did on the others. Our purpose from the newspapers is to say that anybody whose safety may be in jeopardy because of the work they did should have some protection in the public records. That's not a problem. I'm still a bit unclear with arrest and carrying of a firearm whether every federal agent reaches that level. If you saw, as we did in the AG discussion, the AG made a decision that not every AG needed the ability to exempt themselves, that there were, you know, certain AGs working in areas that weren't end up being a threat. I don't know if every federal agent who has the ability to arrest or carries a firearm faces a threat. When we did the bill originally 2 years ago, the certified police officers were able to come in and bring in real examples of things that happened. And those are the things that drive us on the public records bill to say, wait a minute, there needs to be an exemption here. We need to balance the public record here. The amendment also expands this from voter records to ODOT. And we've had a great deal of discussion before as to which set of public records. And there are different groups of people that use public records for different, and I'll let Paul talk about that. But we had a great deal of discussion as to which public records and a number of amendments and so forth. The last thing I'll say is that Senator Burdick wants to continue this discussion and other discussions in an interim work group on these types of public record exemptions. We kind of deal with these one after another, one at a time, and a lot of it in kind of a what if there's a potential problem here, there's a potential threat, what about identity theft? We've never really kind of put these together and developed a set of criteria that would say when does somebody's name and address, which is all over for public employees and for a lot of other people, not just public employees. Voter records are out there for everybody. What criteria should there be for taking a person's name off those kinds of lists? So while I don't just oppose this amendment outright, it may be a very good and worthwhile amendment that expands the safety to federal officers that we've agreed to state officers. I'm just unable to say I support it because we haven't been able to vet it the same way we have with others. And I'll stop there.
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we have absolutely no problem whatsoever with Angro's Senate Bill 1086 as it stands today. We appreciate the fact that its focus was narrowed to the problem that was described and not expanded to include other records and situations, so it avoids the unintended consequences that we were concerned about with respect to the previous version of the bill. The Dash 8 amendments, as in the case of Mr. Gallagher, I just saw these this morning about an hour and a half ago, and the difficulty that I have is much the same as what was described by Mr. Gallagher. This is a complicated issue. It involves costs to those who have those records. We also want to assure for the people who are or have been public safety officers or deputy district attorneys or district attorneys or assistant attorneys general or other categories of people who put their life on the line when they perform a valid and useful public function. We want to keep them protected from people who are going to use these records for purposes other than what they were intended. They include, to a great extent, our own employees. And we want to keep our own employees protected from those people as well. But I can't tell from looking at these amendments what the impact may be. It's going to go into a section of the law that provides for a balancing test that says that these records would be not available for public disclosure unless public interest requires otherwise. Who would make that determination? At what point in time that determination would be made? There are former officers, deputy district attorneys, assistant attorneys general, people whose records might be necessary for disclosure. That's an aspect to it. I can't tell, since this amendment deletes existing law and inserts new law.
Yeah. Mr. Snyder, I think we get the picture on your concerns. Unless there are questions from the committee, I think we've drawn those issues out.
Thank
I want
you,
to make
Mr.
sure we have enough time to address this. So if there are no questions, then I'll excuse these two witnesses. And I want to bring them up on a different set of amendments, Ross Day and Dan Eisenweiss together on the Dash 6 amendments that we're proposing to go on. And Mr. Day, if you could...
We delivered them to the committee yesterday.
The Dash 6 amendments?
We don't have them.
And it's pretty short here, so you probably don't have to have it... Well, you should have it in front of you. Yeah, we can quickly make copies because if there's a consensus here, we may be acting on these.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your record. Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs of the Oregonians in Action. I'm going to say the phrase that you probably hope you didn't hear this session, Measure 49. Okay, there. I just got it out on the table. This tangentially relates to Measure 49. The questions come up. Under Measure 49, you're going to get, when you go through either the express lane or the conditional path, you're going to get something back when it's all said and done from the state, either, and they're calling it the ticket. The questions come up, what do we do with the ticket? And I think uniformly everyone said, well, you go record it. Well, turns out there's a statute that says what can be recorded. So all the amendments do is add a final decision under either Section 6 or 7. These are only retroactive decisions, either under the express lane or the conditional path, that are no longer subject to the appeal. In other words, the appeal period has run, or there's the appeal has gone to its final conclusion. Only those can be recorded under the recording statutes. That's all the amendment does. It just adds a 26th item to the recording statute. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, so just to paraphrase for the committee, what this means is the development rights that are allowed under Measure 49 then could be recorded, so the property owner who has them and other affected nearby owners
right.
would be able to see on the public record what those Measure 49 development rights are. Mr. Eisenweiss, could you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenweiss, 1000 Friends of Oregon.
The language before you is the result of multiple iterations to get at a very specific issue, and that is to allow recording of waivers that are issued under Measure 49 for retrospective claims under the express or conditional paths that are in fact transferable to a subsequent owner with limited development rights. This would not allow the recording of waivers that are issued and construed as a vested right under Measure 37 or prospective claims under Measure 49, because in both cases, those uses become a non-conforming use once the property is transferred to a subsequent owner. So there's, in fact, no need for that, and to allow recording may cause confusion or a mess. 1,000 Friends is supportive of this amendment. We have no position on the underlying bill, and we defer to the committee's wisdom as to whether there's time to amend the bill and move it forward this session. If this were to be revisited in 2009, I don't think that it would harm any of the interested parties.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might just want to reiterate, yes, 1,000 Friends and Oregonians in Action are agreeing on an amendment.
That's a historic day.
How can you say no to that?
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Hearing none, then we'll excuse them. And that concludes the list of witnesses on Senate Bill 1086. I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, Andrew.
Ms. Meyer.
Could you come forward? Very briefly.
Chairman Chris, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Simply want to comment on our concerns about the Dash 8. We look at the public record and then look at safety issues. Public record's very important to keep open, but safety issues are the balance, and this is part of, I think, a bigger conversation when we start adding former and other folks into it that we'd like to be a part of and make some thoughtful decisions. So urge you to not include the Dash 8s and leave it for another day for a bigger conversation. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Okay, I am now going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1086, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1086. Committee, we've got a very truncated session, and we need to be moving about our work. What we have is a consensus bill that nobody is in opposition to that came to us from the Senate. We have two sets of amendments, the Dash 8s, which are not a consensus a set of amendments, and we have the Dash 6s, which are a consensus among the two key stakeholders. And the chair's recommendation to the committee would be that we move the Dash 6s, but not the Dash 8s. But it's open for discussion as to how they...
Sure. Mr. Chair, if we move the Dash 6s, we can, with the time frame we're facing, get this through and get in a conference meeting.
If we move it today, I think we will not run out of time on the bill. There is always the hazard that when you have it has to go back to the Senate for concurrence. So one consequence of adding any amendment is that the clock could run out depending on what the larger forces are in play within the session. So there is that risk that if we make any change to the bill as it came to the Senate, that we will be putting an extra obstacle or extra portal that the bill has to get through. Senator Cameron.
Mr. Chair. We heard testimony from our last witnesses that maybe we could deal with that in 09 with the Dash 6s.
The Dash 6s, it would give earlier clarity if we were to act in this session, but it is an issue that would still be, could be then undertaken in the 09 session.
Mr. Chair?
Given
your familiarity with these issues, what is your recommendation, and have you had any conversations with the Senate side about whether there will be any opposition to the Dash 6 amendment?
I think that it's pretty clear there can be no opposition to the Dash 6s, because there was an opportunity for this. This, I think, was vetted well enough among the people who would care that I think it's pretty clear we won't have any opposition. I think the sole issue is, do we want to put an extra portal in front of this bill that the underlying bill needs to move to fix a problem that was created in the last session? And the surest way to get that done is to pass it unamended.
I'm getting acknowledgement that the Senate's going to be okay with moving this thing with the Dash 6 is in it. So sounds like it could still happen.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think we have an opportunity, and I think that the Dash 6 amendments, at least, I'm favorable to the Dash 8 amendments, but I'm sensing that there is some cloud there. So I think we should take action to move
Do I hear a motion on the Dash 6s?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash sixes to Senate Bill 1086.
Representative Cameron moves the dash six amendments into Senate Bill 1086A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the dash sixes are in the bill.
Do I hear a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 1086A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 1086A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Amici?
Aye.
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Singer?
Aye.
Representative
Bissett?
Aye.
Representative Bissett?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair, she missed me.
Aye. Very good. Motion carries. Senate Bill 1086A as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1086A. That was as much of our agenda as we
Who's
can...
Who's a carrier, Mr. Chair?
We have a volunteer for carrying? Representative Cameron. Very good. And then we are going to... we're going to roll over it until tomorrow, the public hearings and possible work sessions on Senate Bill 1088A and Senate Bill 1088 and Senate Bill 1095A. Oh, I beg your pardon. We're going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 1072A for purposes of permitting Representative Wisnik to vote. Chair would entertain a motion to suspend the rules to permit Representative Wisnik to vote.
Or we suspend the rules to allow Representative Wisnik to vote.
Representative Barker has moved a suspension of the rules to permit Representative Wisnik to vote on Senate Bill 1072A. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Representative Wisnik, how do you vote?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for doing that.
We will motion carry. The bill moves unanimously. I will reclose the work session on Senate Bill 1072A. That concludes our agenda. We are adjourned for Tuesday, February 19, 2008.